Blog Talk Radio.
Evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
Yeah, and I'm Leo. And tonight we're going to do some news.
Do we have our recording from last?
No, I haven't been able to do that.
Well, you're going to have to get some.
I'll be getting it tomorrow. So we'll be able to have it forever.
Well, we can't bring
until the next one breaks down.
We can't bring them the good interview that we had. That's too bad.
I know,
it was
we'll bring it to them next week.
But I think we'll play that audio piece on our...
Yes, that's a good one.
Yeah, because I think people should know about what happened to Chaff's family.
Yeah, and we'll do that. That's an hour long, though.
Well, we
can pay... We'll bring it down.
We'll play a piece of it anyway. It's very good.
Yeah. So, National Adults and all that.
We'll bring you some news in a second.
Having the foot. Well, he's flipped out. I have a feeling this guy's been flipping out lately. So, let's get out of here. He hasn't been on norm lately.
Oh. We'll bring you some news in a minute. We're desperately trying to get some news here. We have some news from last night, but we wanted something a little bit more current.
Spookland man Jacob Lusch just slashed up the head.
That might be interesting.
Yeah. Tyrannus on Times Square bomber threatens U.S. in video. Anti-Israel protester delay flight. Suspicious car. Yeah, you're boring over here. You're boring. U.S. world bully hated by nations. Okay. Let's see. 12 U.S. led soldiers killed in 48 hours. What do you think? Any of these things look interesting to you?
You're going too fast. I can't.
Well, Castro says U.S. is provoking war on Iran.
Let's read that.
He's probably right there.
Castro.
July.
In a rare television appearance after 4 years, former Cuban President Fidel Castro has warned that U.S. tension with Iran could erupt into a full-fledged war. I think that the danger of war is growing a lot. They are playing with fire, Castro said during the 75-minute conversation on a daily Cuban talk show, criticizing the large number of U.S. nuclear arsenal and Washington's heavy military spending. Castro cautioned the White House that an attack on Iran would be catastrophic for it.
Yeah. So, let's see what else. Libyan ship with Gaza aid arrives in an Egyptian port. A ship loaded with aid supplies for Gaza is docked in an Egyptian port, ending the latest attempt by activists to break Israel's Gaza blockade. The vessel was intercepted by Israeli naval ships off the coast of Gaza and forced to head south. The charity which chartered the ship said the charity headed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's son said it wanted to reach Gaza but would not risk violence. Okay. Sounds like a real terrorist guy to me.
Yeah.
Come on. And,
so what's going to happen to the goods? They just sit in the Egyptian port?
Yeah, that's about it.
But nobody cares.
Yeah, who cares?
FCC indecency rules struck down by appeals court. A federal appeals court on Tuesday struck down the government's longstanding... I can't see it.
It's coming up with the actual article. Okay.
A three-judge panel in New York says a rule on unscripted expletives on live broadcast TV and radio creates a chilling effect in violation of the First Amendment. The ruling is a major victory for broadcast networks. Reporting from Washington and Los Angeles in a sharp rebuke of the Bush-era crackdown on foul language on broadcast television and radio, a federal appeals court on Tuesday struck down the government's near-zero-tolerance indecency policy as a violation of the First Amendment protection of free speech. The ruling, a major victory for broadcast TV networks, which jointly sued this federal communications commission in 2006. The case was triggered by an unscripted expletive uttered by Bono, Cher, and Nicole Richie on an award show earlier in the decade, and the court's decision calls into question the FCC's regulation of foul language and other indecent content on the public airwaves.
It does make it much harder for the FCC to regulate this area. Professor who specializes in First Amendment law, he called the ruling a very important decision whose ultimate fate could rest with the U.S. Supreme Court. The three-judge panel of the U.S. and the Circuit Court of Appeals did not have the power to strike down a 1978 Supreme Court decision that affirmed the FCC's right to police the airwaves for objectionable content, but it reversed the aggressive stance the agency took starting in 2004 that found even a slip of the tongue that got by network censors was a violation subject to fines for the stations that aired it. The court said that the policy on so-called pleading expletives was unconstitutionally vague and created a chilling effect on the programs that broadcasters chose to air. The courts echoed complaints from networks executives. The FCC's standards were nearly impossible to gauge, noting that the agency allowed the airing of the F-word and S-word in broadcasts of the World War II movie, Saving Private Ryan, but not in the PBS miniseries, The Blues. Yeah, but where was that one first played?
I don't know.
I don't remember Private Ryan being played on TV, maybe. Under the current policy, broadcasters must choose between not airing or censoring controversial material. Not surprising what options they choose, the Circuit Judge Buller wrote on Tuesday. Indeed, there's an ample evidence in the record that the FCC's indecency proposal has chilled protected speech. And he goes on and on. So you can read it in the Los Angeles Times if you... LosAngelesTimes.com, I believe, and check it out there. But basically, you can say fuck, shit, damn, and everything else on right now, and we usually do sooner or later. Let me see what else there is, if anything exciting.
Why don't you go to Ross story?
No, I was going to go to InfoWars, probably. Usually have something. Update you in a second with the latest and greatest. Let's see. Top Clinton official, only a terror attack can save Obama. Huh? Should be interesting. Paul Jones, what? Bilderberger Shapiro says president needs new OKC or 911 as a way of demonstrating that he is a leader before November election and reversing plunging approval ratings. Man, that sounds good, huh? If they come up with another one of those.
Oh, they're talking about it. They always tell you. A former senior advisor to President Bill Clinton,
they don't name him,
says the only thing that which could rescue Barack Obama's increasingly tenuous grip on power as his approval figures continue to plunge is a terror attack on a scale of Oklahoma City or 911. Another startling reminder that such events only ever serve to benefit those in authority. Buried in the Financial Times article about Obama's growing credibility crisis and fears on behalf of Democrats that they could lose not only the White House but also the Senate to Republicans, Robert Shapiro made it clear that Obama is relying on an October surprise in the form of a terror attack to rescue his presidency.
The bottom line here is that the Americans don't believe in President Obama's leadership, said Shapiro, adding, he has to find some way to, between now and November, of demonstrating that he is a leader who can command confidence and short a 9/11 event or global bombing, I can't think of how he could do that. Shapiro's veiled warning should not be dismissed lightly. He was Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs during Clinton's tenure in the Oval Office, and also acted as principal economic advisor to Clinton in his 1991-92 campaign. Shapiro is now director of the Globalization Initiative of NDN and also chair of the Climate Task Force.
Do you know what NDN is?
I have no idea. Nor do I give a shit. Okay, this is one of those other globalist initiatives. He is a prominent globalist who has attended numerous Bilderberg Group meetings over the past decade.
Shapiro is clearly communicating the necessity for a terror attack to be launched in order to give Obama the opportunity to unite the country around his agenda in the name of fighting terrorists, just as President Bush did in the aftermath of 9/11 when his approval rating shot up from around 50% to well over 80%. Similarly, Bill Clinton was able to extinguish an anti-incumbent rebellion which was brewing in the mid-1990s by exploiting the Oklahoma City bombing to demonize his political enemies as right-wing extremists, as Jack Cashel,
yeah.
I can see the S, points out Clinton descended on Oklahoma City with an approval rating in the low 40s and left town with the rating well above 50 in the Republican Revolution buried in the rubble.
And along with 100 Waco, innocent Waco, Texas kids. Anti-incumbent fever is dominating the political climate once again, and with present establishment Democrats facing serious challenges from Tea Party candidates, people like Senator Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid, who has a battle on his hands against Sharron Engel, a candidate the establishment media has attempted to demonize as a right-wing extremist because she supports populist measures that removing sodium fluoride from water supplies and supports the Oath Keepers Group, an organization centered around upholding states' rights and U.S. Constitution. What's wrong with that? I don't see why there's a problem with this girl. Only by exploiting a domestic terror attack, which can be blamed on right-wing radicals, can Obama hope to reverse the tide of anti-incumbency candidates that threaten to drastically dilute the power monopoly of establishment candidates from both major political parties. As he highlighted yesterday, Shapiro is by no means the first to point out that a terror attack on U.S. soil and indeed anywhere in the world serves only to benefit those in positions of power.
No kidding, huh?
Yeah, Rick Sanchez on CNN admitted in his show this week that the deadly bombings in Uganda, which helped kill 74 people, were helpful to the military-industrial complex agenda to expand the war on terror into Africa. And during the latter years of Bush presidency, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld mused with the Pentagon top brass that shrinking Capitol Hill support for expanding the war on terror could be corrected with the rate of another terror attack. And so it goes on. So these guys have been planning this kind of crap all along, and they're probably just about ready to do another one. You know, so, makes sense to me.
And they give you ample warning.
Yeah, he said, we told you. Michael Edwards, is military spending enslaving us, but are enslaving ourselves when we support the concept of war itself? Of course. Self-explanatory. Wall Street Journal. Times, six New Orleans police officers are charged in connection with deadly act. It's all old stuff.
Yeah. Go to roster.
Yeah. Get out of here.
Or a prison plant.
It's just, that's part of it. Let's see.
I would like that better.
We're going coming right to it here, so hang on. That's always a good one. America stands on the precipice of total collapse.
Okay. There can be little doubt that America, along with the West as a whole, is being set up for a total collapse in which life as we know it will be fundamentally altered and rebuilt around a collectivist model managed and controlled by the same criminals who engineered the crisis in the first place. America has been targeted for an economic, military, and social coup d'etat by globalists who know that to get people to accept a new way of life under the heel of the New World Order would require that the pillars of everything they knew before be completely pulverized. Freedom, prosperity, and commonly and community have no place in a post-industrial revolution, and every assault on the living standards of American citizens is designed to infect and wither these ideals.
We are looking at a road warrior-style collapse of society within 2 years if the entities that orchestrated the crisis are allowed to pose as saviors and institute their austerity, fascism, carbon taxes, green economy, post-industrial revolution, and the evisceration of America's first world status that will inevitably follow if such
measures
are
allowed
to pass. The plan for America is to sink the country into chaos so that it can be swallowed whole and consumed as part of the march toward global government. The globalists want to do to America what they have done to the third world by creating an underclass of impoverished and deprived citizens who are dependent on government for their every need. And millions of Americans have been dubbed down to the point where, as major newspapers announce that the country is heading into a third Great Depression, as unemployment soars, as police departments announce they are no longer be responding to crimes, as infrastructure crumbles, the top story this afternoon on Yahoo, the most heavily trafficked website in the country, was now how Brad Pitt has shaved off his beard.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Likewise, as society and the economy collapses around them, Americans are more concerned about protesting the decision of a basketball player to move to another team. However, a growing number of grassroots movements are now bringing people together under the banner of resentment against big government. This has led to political victories for anti-incumbent candidates who now seriously threaten to dilute the two-party power monopoly in Washington this November. This has led individual core close to Obama to openly invoke the need for a domestic terror attack as the only way to rescue his presidency and the wider collectivist agenda.
Globalists are in a race against time to completely destroy everything America stood for so that they can rebuild the country in their likeness. This is why central banks are now abandoning the U.S. dollar as part of the move towards a global union currency backed by a global central bank that will become the world reserve currency for the new world order.
This is why police departments are now announcing that they will no longer respond to whole lists of crimes, including burglary. A certain level of lawlessness has to exist in order to justify the total police state lockdown that will inevitably ensue after widespread rioting begins to break out. This is why crippling austerity measures are being rammed through even as income drops and jobs are lost. Basic services will skyrocket in price or be cut off completely as America is subjected to the shock therapy that has been inflicted on lesser nations as a way of gelding the people to accept substandard lives of squalor and dependence. And energy prices will soar after the disastrous green economy initiatives are implemented, while toll roads, Obamacare, and all manners of new consumption taxes will dry up whatever disposable income they have left.
The world government will be built from the ashes of the worldwide depression engineered by the financial terrorists who set in motion a chain of events that only has one conclusion unless we are able to properly identify these globalists for who they are. Anyone in a position of power who is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, or the Trilateral Commission is an enemy of America and needs to be stripped of their office, shorn of their influence, and identified as a criminal working behind the scenes to bring about the end of the U.S. as a first world nation. Only through exposure and a political drive to squeeze the influence and power of these individuals can we hope to lessen the impact of the nightmare plans for America.
Yeah. So.
Oh, what's he say on this?
This is probably the same thing. Maybe we can listen. This is Alex Jones.
My friends, the United States is transitioning from a free nation to a police state. The country as we know it is ceasing to exist on every front. Private central banks took over the United States in 1913. They've used this as an engine of global domination. Now they've basically run up the country's credit card and preparing to bankrupt this nation by design. Here's CNN. Central banks start to abandon the U.S. dollar. There's mounting evidence that central banks have little faith in the greenback these days. Can we blame them? Like, they're the good guys, and they're just trying to... authors of the catastrophe that is now unfolding. And I'm going to cover that information in a moment. But first, I want to define austerity. This is what the IMF and World Bank, the private holding companies for the private central banks, have done all over the world. They go in, they get countries in debt by design. It's all fiat loans that they give them, so they gain the world through nothing. It's like an Aladdin's lamp. It's just free money. But with it, they're able to conquer the world. That's what Thomas Jefferson said, that if you ever let private banks issue the currency and credit, our children would wake up homeless on the continent that our forefathers had conquered. And that's now... happening. You look at the austerity systems they set up in the third world, it's now being done to Greece, to Spain, to the United States. They take giant loans they can never pay back. Then when the society collapses, the very banks come in and loan them more fiat money. And now it's happening here. Notice what's developing in Arizona. Obama told Senator Kyle that, well, I'm going to let that crisis and all the thousands of deaths and lawlessness continue because this crisis is good to get amnesty passed. That's holding the country hostage. And what's happening in places like Ohio? Major sheriff's departments are laying off more than half of their deputies and saying the deputies they're keeping are going to be there for revenue generation, writing you tickets, putting people in jail for unpaid fines, but not responding to crime. In fact, in one county, WKYC NBC reports that they're going to lay off the vast majority of their deputies from 112 to 49. But the sheriff's being honest there. He's saying, go out and buy a gun. You've got to protect yourself. And now the police in Oakland, California are holding the population hostage, saying, look, if we don't raise taxes, if we don't get more funding, we're not going to be able to respond to serious crimes. The police are saying, we're not going to respond to grand theft auto, to burglary, to muggings, to all of these serious things. And as the government grows, you don't get essential services like bridges and roads being fixed. Those are falling apart. You don't get police and fire. Los Angeles is announcing they're not going to fix the sidewalks now. All you get is a parasitic government basically feeding off of you, and it's outrageous. The police are saying, we're not going to protect you. Now, the Supreme Court has always ruled that the police have no liability to protect you, that it's your job to protect yourself. They respond after a crime has been committed. But now they're being completely honest about this and saying, look, you're here for revenue generation for the government. But there's a lot of good news coming in. Arizona newspapers are reporting that the freeway speed cameras are being removed from the entire state because the vast majority of the population have refused to pay the tickets. There is now non-compliance happening all over the state of Arizona, not only to the illegal alien invasion and the designed implosion of the country to merge us into the North American Union, which is officially stated by the last two White Houses. But now the public is wearing guns in the open. They're not paying speeding tickets. They're saying, you're an illegitimate government, and we're not going along with this, and the government is having to back off. Here's another example out of USA Today. There is a huge backlash against the naked body scanners. They admit they are recording your naked genitals. It is a biometric scan that's being stored. We've had airport employees getting fistfights when other employees make fun of the size of their sexual organs. And the airlines are getting upset because people aren't flying anymore. And the feds are starting to have to back off what they originally did. They were trying to break our will, to condition us, to make us submit. So the moral of the story is, when we say no, we can have an effect. We've got to continue to say no and say no in greater numbers because the time is short. This orchestrated implosion of the world economy is a military form of financial terrorism. I told my listeners 11 years ago when they got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act that derivatives would be used to bankrupt our nation and every other wealthy nation because I've seen the very same private banks do this in the third world. And now here we are, 11 years later, it's happening. Whether it's the New York Times or CNBC, they are admitting that we are now in a depression. But even more importantly, the communist Chinese, who hold the majority of European and U.S. debt, have now downgraded the United States and Europe. They are turning us into actual debtor slaves, and suddenly the globalist think tanks are announcing China will be the future, and the base of the new one-world government will be China. This is high treason by the leaders of our nation who have always wanted to destroy this country and convert it to a collectivist system where they can manipulate and control every facet of our lives. The bad news is out there. We are going into a global depression. It has been engineered by design. But the good news is, worldwide, the population is waking up. And as Zbigniew Brzezinski said 2 months ago, that the elite are in trouble because for the first time in world history, the entire planet is awakening. Now is the most important time in modern history. Our society is at a crossroads, and everything you do to get the word out about this outrageous crime that's taking place brings us one step closer to defeating these people. We must say no to the new global currency and the SDRs. We must say no to devaluing the dollar. We must say no to financial reform bill that actually gives these bankers more control over our economy. We must stand up and defend the republic and restore our constitution and remember that the answer to 1984 is 1776. Thank you for watching.
And in your case, folks, thanks for listening to us.
Yeah. So let's see. There's so many more good things that we can do here. Why BP is readying a super weapon to avert escalating Gulf nightmare. In its desperate attempt to stop a huge area of Gulf ocean floor from possibly rupturing due to a subterranean methane gas leading to calamity no human has ever seen, BP has ripped a page from science fiction books. The giant oil company is now quietly preparing to test a small nuclear device in a frenzied rush against time to quell a cascading catastrophe. If successful, they will have the capability to detonate a controlled fusion-generated pulse. While the world watches BP's attempt to contain the oil gusher at the former Deepwater Horizon site, company officials have given the green light on the astounding plan to use what is known as a nuclear EPFCG charge, if all else fails. Seafloor compromise. Reports still indicate that methane is flooding the Gulf waters at a rate of 1 million times more than normal, and the NOAA research vessel Thomas Jefferson has reported spotting new fissures. Last week, the science ship stunned some reporters with a revelation that the oceanographic team had discovered that and measured a rift in the ocean floor miles from the BP wellhead. The rift was reported to be more than 100 feet long and widening. Oil and methane continues to plume from that rift. Do you hear that?
That's really scary.
BP has also admitted damage beneath the seafloor.
Beneath the seafloor?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Omega Plan. Most enterprises, whether business, government, or exploration, have a plan B to fall back on. State BP has attempted plans B through N, yet it is the last-ditch plan, that Omega Plan, that hold the great risk. Yet the plan may be the final hope to stop what some consider a catastrophe that could culminate with a world-killing mass extinction event that modern civilization could not survive. At a super-secret security base, Suffield, located in southern Alberta, Canada, area reports indicate that high-level engineers, physicists, and military scientists are feverishly working to complete an explosive pump flux compressor generator.
What's that going to do?
According to published scientific papers, an EPFCG generator can be powered by a very small controlled fusion explosion, in other words, a tiny nuclear bomb. Why the UK-based BP has set up operations in Suffield is obvious. The company already runs three oil rigs on the base. I've worked with Canada's chemical and biological efforts on and off for 40 years and have strong ties to Commonwealth infrastructure. But anyway, they plan to use this. The device can only be used once and generates a high-power electromagnetic pulse. It achieves this by using a powerful explosion, explosive, preferably nuclear advanced, nuclear-driven, and can instantaneously create up to billions of amperes and hundreds of tetrawatts. Such raw power exceeds lightning bolts by huge orders of magnitude. The pulse can be shaped and directed and used to knock out electronics or other, importantly, in this case, to fuse virtually any material, including crumbling rock strata deep under the sea. The fantastically energized pulse can also...
That's the HARP. It's like the HARP project. That's what that is.
This is the electronic. This is the nuclear thing.
Oh.
Okay, according to engineers familiar with technology, devices can generate plasmic arcs hotter than the surface of the sun that will melt and fuse materials in nanoseconds. The special security force manned by members of UK Parliament Security and Blackwater Security is noted to have cordoned off the base. The security lid has clamped down hard while the engineers and scientists work. BP secret Omega plan kicked off in the earliest on July 7th, according to the sources on the base of the British blah, 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 and Halliburton has set up a test site at one of the drill rigs. While the plan would admittedly not be executed if a worst-case scenario seemed imminent, some geochemists have expressed concerns that detonating an EFMG in the Gulf might ignite the methane.
Oh, wow. And then what would happen?
Meanwhile, the preparations for the test continue in Canada.
It'd be like a fireball.
It would be ridiculous. I can't even imagine what it would be.
Now, do we have the audio part for...
Yeah, I gotta go to it, right?
Yeah.
And, I'll get that. Let's see.
We had a guest last night on our FM show. Unfortunately, we couldn't tape the interview, but which was excellent. He was really good. Poor guy had just arrived at the airport. He didn't have time to go home and set up before he talked to us. I thought it was very good of him to speak to us.
From the airport, yeah. We'll have that interview next week. This week we're kind of screwed up. Our equipment here. It was the political prosecutions of Karl Rove, and... This is from politicalprosecutions.org, which is a great website here. This is regarding the prosecutions by Karl Rove, or instigated by Karl Rove, against over 600 local and state and federal
office holders,
right, who were not...
Who were an integral part of the Democratic Party, and his...
Not necessarily. There were moderate Republicans too,
that were in his way.
That were not judges, politicians, local mayors, different people. So this was very, very, very frightening. And this, I'm going to ask everybody to possibly go to this. This interview is about an hour long. I will just play about.
When some regimes fall, the truth leaks out like the odor of unmarked.
So I hope you enjoy it.
When some regimes fall, the truth leaks out like the odor of unmarked graves. We just never thought it'd be happening to us. The U.S. attorney scandal is far larger and involves many more people than most of us realize. Beyond Governor Siegelman, who was marched off in chains by a Republican judge, and Georgia Thompson, the Wisconsin state employee who was jailed in an effort to force testimony against a Democratic governor, the House Judiciary Committee has learned that the Bush Justice Department targeted more than 600 local elected officials and probably 2,500 collateral cases, 85% of whom happen to be Democrats.
2001 to today, it has been a nightmare. I had my son with me. He was 7 years old, and he can only be frightened that his dad is being visited by people flashing badges at 6:30 in the morning.
The FBI started visiting folks at, 10, 11 p.m. There were people who were, were visited and basically shown like a picture and said, "Do you know this person?" And, an old lady would say, "Yeah, that's my daughter." "Oh, thank you. That's all we needed to find out." But of course, they do that just to intimidate you.
They were threatening to charge my lawyer's son with something heavy, I don't know what. And the next thing I knew, my lawyer had completely changed his demeanor about my case and was telling me I needed to get ready to go to jail.
They were so intent to get me that they didn't care if they hurt Jean or Dave's sister, family, or the grandchildren. They didn't care.
They threatened my little sister, Valerie, with indictment, and they threatened his mother, my grandmother, Alice Balance, who's 80-plus years old at the time. They threatened to indict her.
Had the FBI walk in and say, "If you don't talk to us right now, we're going to put contempt orders against you," and had them in tears.
Justice Department terrorized them and threatened them with criminal prosecution for 2 years leading up to my trial, telling them that they would go to prison if they didn't testify against me and didn't lie against me.
The Judiciary Committee learned that these prosecutions were ordered by Karl Rove and carried out by a party activist and Federalist Society member named Noel Hillman. They were concentrated in this arc of states, and these, perhaps not so coincidentally, are the states where the margin of victory in the previous two elections had been less than 3%, and these are the states from 2005 on where U.S. attorneys were replaced by Federalist Society members.
The FBI continued to go out and harass these individuals because they had made contributions either to me or to other Democrats. And I think it's very clear that the purpose of the whole investigation and the interrogations was to limit my ability as a Democratic office holder to raise money.
He said to Wes, "You better come up with something or you will be indicted." And Wes said, "What do you want me to do? Lie?" And he said, "You do whatever it takes."
Federal courts have an elaborate system to guarantee randomness in the assignment of judges. But in these states, 79, 80, 85, 90, and 100% of the political cases somehow wound up going to Bush judges.
A crime occurs. You investigate that crime, you determine who committed that crime. We have now broadened the criminal justice system to be, we receive information about a person, we investigate the person, and then we find out what crimes they committed. So in essence, what we're doing is creating crimes.
The prosecutor said, "When we convict your client, we will put him in jail for a very long time." That these types of in-kind contributions are treated in such a cavalier manner that someone needs to be made an example of.
Finally, something we'd never imagined, consequently had never gone looking for, but once we saw it there in the statistics, was so chilling it was impossible to ignore, is that nearly every sentence handed out by Bush judges in political cases from 2004 on, no matter how short the period of incarceration, had a probation extending through the 2008 election, effectively guaranteeing government control and silence from the defendant.
This opened my eyes. I found out that the federal government can be used against you the way it was used against Jared and I. It destroyed us.
Prosecutors have said we are going to need somebody to look after our children because, we're both looking at maybe going to prison.
I actually have to go walk into a court of law in my country and stand before a judge and plead guilty to something I didn't do. And I did that for my children.
the prosecutor can threaten to indict somebody else unless you plead. You can threaten a person with 50 years in jail unless they plead guilty. Is the person pleading voluntarily? Well, the judge says in court, is your plea voluntary? Does anybody threaten you? No, judge. It's a voluntary plea. Is that coercive? Of course it's coercive.
Meg Scott Phipps is the daughter and granddaughter of North Carolina governors and was thought likely to run for that office herself. The U.S. Attorney Frank Whitney accused her of using the state fair to raise campaign contributions, an act which he expressed in some 30 separate felonies. He indicted or threatened just about everyone around her, including her husband and her 75-year-old father. He convicted Meg of perjury, essentially for continuing to deny that she was a criminal. Once he had her in custody, he kept her incommunicado for nearly 3 weeks by moving her between multiple jails in several states until she was sufficiently terrorized to plead guilty to lesser charges. The Republican district court judge saw nothing improper in any of this and immediately gave her the maximum sentence.
Meg eventually ended up in federal prison for 3 years at a time when we had a daughter that was 15, a son that was 14. We ended up selling the farm that we had bought from her parents. All the witnesses against Meg had already been indicted. They were told that they would be let off if they turned. We could have won that trial had Meg not decided, no, I'm not going to put my husband and my father through that. And part of the reason that Meg did that was that she knew that one of us had to be around for the kids.
I think it's reasonable to assume, given the evidence which has come to light now, was a policy adopted by Karl Rove to establish a permanent Republican majority. The Republicans have control of the presidency. They have control of the Supreme Court, and they have control of both houses of Congress. How do you preserve that control and make that control permanent? And the answer to that is you start attacking the lower level of the Democratic Party in such a way that you can undermine both potential candidates for office.
At the time, I was going through a primary campaign.
I was a very busy city council person at the time. And also potential sources of both fundraising and other support.
I was the top, if not one of the top, campaign contributors to the Democratic Party in Michigan since I ran for governor in 1998.
And if you look at what they did, they were very effective in doing it. Mr. Rove is very smart. And what he understood is that if you indict a senator or a congressman, or a governor, that may make national news. But if you indict someone who's in the state legislature, someone who's a county executive, someone who's a local official, that doesn't make the national news. It achieves the objective of undermining the Democratic Party and its ability to rebound. It achieves the objective of creating the impression that the Democratic Party and its members are somehow corrupt. It achieves the objective of costing a heck of a lot of money to those people. And it stays below the national radar.
Sandra McFadden Weaver had once co-signed a loan to help a parishioner buy a house. Later, the FBI agents assigned to Paul through her life discovered that the loan papers said that she would actually live in that house, which, of course, she hadn't. This they called mortgage fraud. Reverend Weaver resisted until bankrupt.
Then they rolled around to this thing and blew up this big, oh, she's a fraud, she's a felon, she's a this, and blew all that kind of stuff up right before election. Of course, during campaign time, all of it was very well timed, it appeared to me. It doesn't matter to certain people whether or not the truth ever comes out. It matters to some people that that they get certain people. They want to silence certain voices.
Assemblyman Mezzatesta got a grant to train the volunteer fire departments in his district. Being a frugal man, he managed to stretch the grant to train several departments beyond his district. U.S. Attorney Valdrini labeled that vote-buying and managed to put the issue in front of a Bush judge, who allowed it to go forward in spite of the obvious fact that the firemen involved were outside of Jerry's district and couldn't possibly have voted for him anyway. A piece of information which the U.S. Attorney actually tried to hide from the jury.
We are guaranteed, supposedly guaranteed, that we'll get a fair trial and justice will prevail. However, is that doesn't seem that's the way it is right now.
The federal crimes are so vast. If you look at the crimes in the federal code, you wouldn't believe the thousands and thousands and thousands of crimes, oftentimes overlapping, oftentimes very technical. But you could almost look at the United States Code, you could find a crime to fit almost anybody that you were investigating. I mean, if you put a letter in a mailbox which has a misstatement on it, it's mail fraud. It's mail fraud. Any prosecutor can indict anybody before any grand jury for almost anything. And with a favorable judge giving the jury the legal instructions that are conducive towards jury convicting, you're going to get a conviction, likely.
Government in Puerto Rico has always been pretty much the governor's office, that no senators and only a ceremonial congressman. So a young tourist commissioner, the only Republican anywhere near the Puerto Rican government in decades, must have thought he'd landed in tall cotton.
There are over a million Puerto Ricans that have moved to Florida over the last 15 years. The question for the Republican Party was, how can we get those Puerto Ricans to sort of move to the Republican Party? And the answer, I think, for Roe was, let's make sure we have a Republican governor in Puerto Rico, and let's make sure that Republican governor can go and influence our friends in Florida.
Roe soon had himself a Republican congressman from Puerto Rico. He invited the campaign manager, a former RNC opposition researcher, to come hang out in his office for a while. A few weeks later, a Rose Amelia Rodriguez was nominated U.S. Attorney for Puerto Rico. Even the Republican Senate found her unqualified, so Roe had her named temporary U.S. Attorney until a real one could be named.
I spoke to Ambassador Cesar Cabrera at the University Club in Washington, D.C., sometime in 2006. And Ambassador Cabrera basically said, look, they're coming after your governor. So my advice to you is stop working for the governor, go on to private practice, get out of business. And then he said, there is not enough information to put him in jail, but there is enough to indict him and destroy him politically.
The investigation, it was not to find out if or whether a crime had been committed, and if so, who committed it. It was to find out what can we get on Governor Acevedo.
Rosa Amelia jailed or indicted nearly everyone around Acevedo, including a dentist in Pennsylvania, until she could finally find someone who would testify as she wished. They shipped a Bush judge all the way from New Hampshire, and 4 months before the election announced a 24 felony indictment of Acevedo, two-thirds of which was so flimsy that even the Federalist Society judge had to throw it out. He needed to think about it until the week after the election, however. So as of March 2009, the tourism commissioner is governor, his campaign manager runs the Puerto Rican government, and Annabel Acevedo sits at trial before a judge who next month will probably have the chance to sentence him to 20 years in prison.
So many people in Puerto Rico are just afraid, and so many people, I think, are unfortunately willing to just give in and plead guilty on charges that are just not true. There is something absolutely wrong when in the American system people are afraid of the government.
Well, one of the clear dividing lines between a democratic society and authoritarian or totalitarian society has to do with how the criminal justice process operates. And Robert H. Jackson, probably the greatest attorney general in U.S. history, set out this distinction very clearly in a famous speech he gave called the federal prosecutor. The critical distinction is whether you're investigating crimes or investigating people. The body of the criminal law in our country is such that it's a simple fact that everyone commits crimes all the time because our statutes are sweeping in their scope. And this is particularly true of the political process, where we have rules about how money is raised and how money is spent in appropriations and solicitations and contacts that could criminalize effectively absolutely anyone if you want to and you turn enough attention to it. So he says this constitutes a very, very dangerous weapon in the hand of a prosecutor who behaves unethically. And in the end, he says, a politically motivated prosecutor is going to be a far more serious enemy of our democracy than the political figures he's targeting.
Senator Charles Walker should have been a poster boy for the Federalist Society. Son of a sharecropper, he'd started a newspaper and a dozen businesses. He put his son through business school, his daughter through law school, and was elected 10 times to the Georgia legislature, ultimately becoming majority leader of the Senate. He was a well-liked, enormously energetic man, and prime material for a Bush prosecutor. On Zero Evidence, Richard Thompson claimed Walker's newspaper had overstated its readership, and that this constituted a fraud on the advertisers. Now, even if true, that was a civil matter and certainly not federal. But Thompson then claimed that each bill sent by the paper constituted a separate act of mail fraud and indicted Senator Walker for nearly 150 felonies. Thompson was becoming so unsubtle in pursuing Democrats that it began to make news. He was quietly removed, given a judgeship, and his case is dropped, except for that against Senator Walker, which Noel Hillman himself ordered to continue. Judge Dudley Bowen was ready to do his part. When defense attorneys used peremptory challenges to bar two Republican activists from the jury, Bowen summarily put them back on. Senator Walker will leave federal prison in 2014.
I'm appalled at the fact that so many of my colleagues in the political arena, whom I've known, and have really lost their lives, their families, that we have people who are incarcerated and locked up for many years, and they really haven't done anything except differ for those who potentially see them as a threat in the political arena.
They just wanted them out of politics, is what it was all about. The sheer volume of charges, over 100, I think it was 142 charges, the word was that we were becoming too powerful. My father was supposed to be running for governor, and I was going to run for Congress. They raided his offices with agents, but the press arrived before the agents arrived.
With all the horrible publicity, not being able to campaign and so forth, and people being fed by the media what they wanted to hear.
The DOJ employs some 300 civic liaison specialists who, when an investigation is announced, distribute FBI files to selected reporters. These have often been collected from political or business rivals, ex-wives, or old enemies.
When we were indicted, it makes headlines all the way across the top half of the front page. Feds indict Morgantown man.
And they then destroyed me for weeks and weeks and weeks on television, on the radio, and in print. It's because these major mainstream news outlets that people turn to where during their breakfast cereal are talking about David Rosen. And that's because someone told them to.
The process was continually plagued by leaks, which the local press ate up. The local press is in the hands of Republican-leaning families. And, of course, the U.S. attorney always said, oh, it's not from us, but the data, the content of the leak could only have come from them because they were the only ones who had the information.
One of the hallmarks that we see going on all across the country has to do with manipulation of the media. So the historical view and the view that was taken in, I think, ethically proper prosecutions is that the case is tried in court. It's not tried in the media. But what we see being done in these abusive prosecutions is consistent. That is, a media war is launched preemptively against the victim of a criminal prosecution. The entire case that the prosecutors have put together is leaked to friendly, cooperating press.
Mike Garcia was never on anybody's list to be fired. A Republican and Federalist Society activist since high school, he used the Patriot Act as cover to send FBI squads through the personal finances of most of the major Democrats in New York, discovering on the way that Governor Spitzer had wired money to an escort service. The fact that there was nothing illegal in that daunted Garcia not one moment. He had the FBI pressure the bank into filing a suspicious activity report, then got a Republican activist in Florida to write a letter claiming to have seen the governor there with a prostitute. He then got a Federalist judge to approve a wiretap of the escort service. Three men, three shifts a day, 7 days a week, listening for just one call. A month later, the governor made it and Garcia had him. He leaked it all to the press, along with the story that the governor was being indicted under the Mann Act, a ridiculous 1910 law about crossing state lines to have sex. He followed that with a daily drumfire about the governor having used $60,000, $80,000, or $100,000 of campaign funds on call girls, all of which were simply lies. They were enough to end Spitzer's career, however. One major Democrat taken off the board with all the ceremony of a high school prank.
It is a criminal act to leak grand jury materials to the press. It undermines the whole criminal justice process, and this was done systematically by the Bush Justice Administration. And many of these political prosecutions, Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, all over the country, we see the same practices occurring. And they'll deny, by the way, we weren't doing anything. What are you talking about? It's all done secretly through carefully cultivated connections with friendly press. And when the defendant tries to respond in kind with its own PR campaign and effort, they'll go running to the judge asking for a gag order and frequently get it, and particularly because one of the other bizarre things we see in all these cases, you know, there are not that many federal judges in the U.S. who have been appointed by George W. Bush, but only judges appointed by George W. Bush wind up being assigned to hear all these cases. I mean, it's like 80 to 90% of the cases, and the odds of that happening by random assignment are about 1 in 10,000. Something strange is going on here.
By almost any measure, Frank Balance had quite a life. After 20 years in the North Carolina legislature, he'd just been elected to Congress. His mother had been a community organizer for half a century. He had one daughter, a doctor, another in college, and a son who'd recently become a state judge.
As I was finishing up court, I had noticed two gentlemen come in, and I thought they might have had a case. But as court ended, and I asked them whether they had any business in the court, they basically told me that they were there to see me, so I just sort of ended court, and then I ended up talking with them and finding out that they were agents, FBI agents.
U.S. Attorney Frank Whitney, having done with Meg Scott Phipps, indicted Frank's son for failing to file a tax return 5 years previously, even though the government had owed him money. He set equally compelling cases against the congressman himself, his daughter, and his mother before Judge Terrence Boyle, Federalist Society, bluntly racist, and among the most reversed judges in the federal judiciary. The congressman spared his family, resigned from the House, and accepted a plea.
This is a picture of me and my dad on my wedding day, walking me down the aisle. Now, my dad is in Butner, North Carolina, in a federal prison. I don't know of any crime committed, so...
Paul Miner was the largest contributor to the Democratic Party in the state of Mississippi. Since judges are elected in Mississippi, they were obviously among the candidates he raised money for. This, the government chose to term bribery.
The U.S. attorney, whose name is Dunn Lambton, who incidentally was on the list to be fired by the Department of Justice, and he is suddenly removed from the list.
If Miner had given bribes, someone obviously must have received them, a role for which U.S. Attorney Lampton chose three Democratic state judges.
The FBI agent who originally was on the case was yanked off of it because he indicated he couldn't find there was any bribery involved.
The first FBI agent that was assigned to the case, he was actually reassigned to Guantanamo Bay at the time. Didn't seem like there was much of a fit for his expertise at Guantanamo Bay, but nevertheless, because he had raised objections about the prosecution, he was reassigned. The basis of the entire prosecution was that I was providing favors to Paul Miner, who had contributed to my campaign. All they had to do was look at the cases, look at my decisions, and see that I have never actually ruled on any of his cases. They seemed to discount that entirely, and the government threatened us with the loss of our children if if we both went to trial. They said that they were sure that we could find somebody good to raise our children while both of us were in prison, if that's indeed what we wanted to do, to go to trial. The three people who were accused along with me in trial were actually retrialed, and they were all found guilty.
They said to Wes, you either resign and agree to never run for another public office again, or we're going to indict you. The judge's name that heard the case was Judge Wingate from Jackson, a federal court judge. Everybody was in shock because it was totally obvious that he was leaning toward the side of the government. And the next night they came back with the verdict of guilty for all of them. He is in Atlanta, Georgia, at a prison camp. This December will be a year that he has been in there. He has four more years to serve.
It's a very serious power what Karl Rove did with opponents to then Governor Bush was to get them indicted, and so that they were no longer effective as opponents. And I think that worked very well for them in Texas, and I think they took that same strategy to the White House.
Rove also launched a set of prosecutions circling each of the possible Democratic presidential candidates. Around John Edwards were indictments of fundraisers Pierce O'Donnell and Jeffrey Feiger.
100 agents raided my offices. That is more FBI agents than was used recently to raid Merrill Lynch, who has and may indeed have brought down the financial system of the United States. Only 25 agents were used there. In Tora Bora, in the pursuit of Osama bin Laden, 40 FBI agents. To give you a more mundane example, if you committed a bank robbery and murdered people, which is a federal crime, you'd be lucky to get two or three FBI agents on your tail. 100 FBI agents raided my office. That is unheard of in American history, and it can only be done with the orders by the powers that be in Washington, D.C., at the top, at the uppermost, at the tippermost top of the pecking order.
After Barack Obama keynoted the 2004 convention, investigations were launched throughout the Illinois government, with indictments following against Anton Rezko, Stuart Levine, Robert Weinstein, and Christopher Kelly. But by far the largest effort was centered around Hillary Clinton, with indictments of security advisor Sandy Berger, fundraisers Aaron Tonkin, Raymond Reggie, James Levin, Norman Sue, Mauricio Chellis, and finance director David Rosen.
I can't say strongly enough how well organized, how integrated, how mission-driven and mean the group that we're trying to take Hillary Clinton out, how powerful that group is. And that group had members of our government involved in it is absolutely true. That they use the power of the state to go after a political enemy happened to me. It happened to me, and I suffered greatly from it. Your rights are all taken away from you. You feel that they can just do anything and be anywhere.
Every single one of them had their office or their home burglared. And then I found out Don Siegelman also had the same thing happen. And it's after the fact that we're right now just starting to connect these dots.
I read about this, that this happens in other countries. And I'm here to say it not only happens in this country, it not only happens in politics, but it happened to me. And the media outlets were part of it. Destroying of my reputation and the slanderous attack via the television, which is such a powerful disseminating tool, it happened. It wasn't coincidence that it happened. It happened. And it only happened in from the organs of the right. It only happened on Hannity and Combs. It only happened on Rush Limbaugh. It only happened with Fox News.
The pursuit of Anthony Pelicano produced a fever of speculation that Mrs. Clinton's largest contributors, Stephen Bing and Ronald Burkle, might be hauled before a grand jury. The government claims the case began when someone dropped a fish on a reporter's car. But but pretty well drowned in all the tabloid nonsense, was the fact that way back in 1992, the detective had apparently been hired by Hillary Clinton herself to discredit a woman named Jennifer Flowers, who was claiming to have slept with Bill. True or not, the story became a permanent part of the right-wing songbook on Mrs. Clinton. It was developed and expanded in lawsuits against her, like this one in 1999, financed by Federalist Society members, and on television by Mary Matlin, and in some pretty rabid books by Barbara Olson. After Bush was elected, Matlin went to the White House as Cheney's counselor, and Olson's husband, Ted, one of the leaders of the Federalist Society, became number three at the Justice Department. Within 6 months, FBI squads in California and New York were combing through divorces whose only common thread was Pelicano.
They created and fabricated.
I guess you get the hint, you get the idea of what's been happening. And there's a quote here. It says, "All tyranny needs to gain a foothold is for people of good conscience to remain silent." That was by Thomas Jefferson. And you got to believe that. I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. And you can go to, you can get the remainder of that 1 hour video on politicalprosecutions.org. And the video is right at the top of their webpage, and it's called The Political Prosecutions of Karl Rove. Next week, I hope to have, I hope we can have the, all of the, we'll be able to have the interview that we did last night with Chap Walker, whose father was indicted and is serving a prison sentence under the Bush Karl Rove prosecutions. And next week we'll be interviewing Oliver Diaz, who is a judge who was on this particular video. And he was indicted in 2003 under totally false pretenses, and was threatened. And he was the one on the video that said that they said that they'd take his children away from him and his wife and indict both of them. And so, but he won twice. He appealed it and won again, and won the judgment. And and they left him alone. However, he lost his position, and he's now a lawyer, a practicing attorney. You know, it's a remarkable problem that has to be looked at. So please go to politicalprosecutions.org and check it out. For yourself, and all right. Thank you very much for listening tonight.